From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, September 27th, 2016. And on this day, Maine Attorney General Janet Mills says the U.S. EPA's Clean Power Plan is crucial to maintaining public health as the state joins 17 others in defending the plan in court. The EPA says a hazardous chemical has been found in drinking water across the U.S., including in Maine. But finding out where chromium-6 is coming from isn't easy. And remembering the worst oil spill in Maine's history. Those stories and much more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu.
I'm Barbara Caridi. The recent deaths of two right whales in the Gulf of Maine and the discovery of another entangled in fishing gear is bringing renewed attention to the plight of the endangered species. Fred Bever reports.
Last Thursday, a right whale was spotted off Provincetown, Massachusetts, swimming but entangled in gear. Friday, a dead female whale was seen off Booth Bay and towed to shore, where its death was determined to be from stress caused by entanglement. Saturday, a dead whale was spotted off Mount Desert Rock, but could not be recovered. With only about 500 right whales left in the world, scientists and other mariners rushed to document the deaths and help the still-living whale. They were able to remove more than 200 feet of gear and buoys from that animal, which swam on. And they found an important piece of information, a U.S.-based fishing license on one of the buoys. Federal officials declined to release more information about that license, pending further investigation, in part to determine whether gear rules were followed. Michael Moore, a scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, says continued entanglements indicate that current rules need work.
The fishermen and the fisheries, the stakeholders, have been put through an enormous amount of gear change and stress in trying to make a more whale-friendly fishery, but we're not out of the woods in any means.
Scientists hope to relocate the Provincetown whale to determine whether it's managed to shuck the rest of the gear it had taken on. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And Maine is one of 18 states that defended the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan today in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington. As Patty White reports, supporters of the plan say it's a landmark move to impose limits on carbon pollution and help address climate change.
If the Clean Power Plan holds up in court, it would require power plants to eventually reduce carbon emissions by 32% from 2005 levels. Maine Attorney General Janet Mills says upholding that standard is critical.
The part of the plan that governs existing plants is expected to eliminate as much climate change pollution as is emitted by more than 160 million cars a year.
Mills says the Clean Power Plan is the culmination of a decade-long effort and allows businesses flexibility in how to comply. Two dozen states are challenging the plan, saying it will increase the cost of electricity and kill jobs. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Meanwhile, data from the EPA find that the carcinogen, often referred to as the Aaron Brockovich chemical, is present in about two-thirds of the drinking water across the country. Low levels of chromium-6 have been found in drinking water in New England, including in Maine. The federal government recognizes that even low levels can be harmful, but has not yet set an enforceable drinking water standard for states to follow. Vermont Public Radio's Kathleen Masterson reports that one challenge is trying to figure out where the chromium-6 is coming from.
Relative to some hotspots in California, Arizona, and Oklahoma, the levels of chromium-6 found in New England drinking water are quite low. Most were under one part per billion. That's billion with a B. Still, even those low levels exceed the public health goal set by the state of California, which is 0.02 parts per billion, says Sarah Vos, the state toxicologist of Vermont.
California did a very reasonable assessment of the carcinogenicity of chrome-6, and I agree for the most part with what their conclusions are regarding the the risk of Chrome 6. There's no doubt that it is a public health concern.
However, Vos points out that while chromium 6 levels in parts of New England are above California's health goal, these levels are below that state's enforceable limit. So even these levels would go untreated in California, the only state with a legally enforceable limit in drinking water. Chromium 6 is a known human carcinogen. Peter Gravatt is the director of the EPA's Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water.
And we've been working on understanding the toxicity of chromium for a number of years, and next year in 2017 we'll be publishing a draft health assessment for chromium.
And frankly, when chromium 6 is present at low levels in drinking water, it's not something that New England states are entirely sure how to treat. Most chromium 6 in the environment comes from industrial sources. It's used for chrome plating, leather tanning, and wood preserving. And it's also found in ash from coal-burning power plants. Another form of the chemical, chromium-3, is naturally occurring in the environment, and it's a nutrient that our bodies need. But chromium-3 can convert to chromium-6 under different conditions. Ellen Parr-Doring is the Deputy Director for the Drinking Water and Groundwater Protection Division in Vermont. She says a big part of the struggle is that it's not entirely clear where the contamination is coming from.
But we kind of need to know what the original source of this is to deal with it, whether it's from atmospheric deposition or it's naturally occurring in the water itself. You'd be thinking treatment plant issues, you know, how can we properly treat there?
Or she says it can be even trickier. There's some evidence that certain chemicals used to make drinking water safer could actually cause this nutrient, chromium-3, to convert to chromium-6. Or it also could be leaching from distribution pipes.
Then you might be looking at another way of dealing with the issue. And right now, at these low levels, it's really hard to figure out what is the issue, like why is that happening?
Parr-Doring says Vermont and other New England states first saw the data on chromium-6 in drinking water when the EPA shared it about a year ago. And state officials did have conversations about the carcinogen.
We hadn't come up with any New England-wide strategy, if you will, nothing like that.
And even if the states knew the source of contamination, it's not clear if it's technically feasible to treat such low levels. The Environmental Working Group has been working to draw attention to the issue across the country. David Andrews is a chemist with the group, and he says the uncertainty around what to do points to a bigger problem.
But overall, I think this issue really raises important questions about our national drinking water infrastructure and the ability of our federal government to essentially keep informed and be able to update drinking water standards as science evolves.
The EPA says it will issue a toxicity assessment of chromium 6 in 2017, and then after a period of public comment, determine if an enforceable drinking water standard should be set. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
And now to that contract to refurbish Boston-area buses that Maine Governor Paul LePage put a halt to last week. The commissioner of the state's Department of Defense, Veterans, and Emergency Management, General Douglas Farnham, says he plans to meet next week with Massachusetts Transit Authority officials about the contract as work on the project continues at the Maine Military Authority facility in Limestone. Mal Leary has more.
General Farnham says he's been in contact with officials at the MBTA to set up a meeting next week to discuss the cost the authority is incurring in refurbishing the dual-power buses. He says the complexity of the buses has led to higher-than-expected costs, and while the cost per bus has improved, the contract is not covering expenses. But work is continuing at the Limestone facility while the contract is being discussed. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Coming up, the two candidates in Maine's 2nd District race are running ads with a similar theme, trying to convince voters that their rivals aren't what they seem, and remembering the worst oil spill in Maine's history. A South Paris man has been found not guilty of reckless conduct in connection with a fatal hayride accident that killed an Oakland teenager in 2014. Prosecutors tried to show that David Brown was criminally reckless in driving a Jeep pulling the hay wagon at a farm in Mechanic Falls. Investigators found that mechanical failure caused the hayride to plunge down an embankment and crash into a tree. But Brown, who still works as a professional driver, said he was not aware of any brake issues. And his attorney, Alan Lobozo, argued that just the day before the accident, Brown had reported a carburetor problem to his bosses. Lobozo says there's a lot of relief in the verdict, but no joy.
Because there's a young woman, a beautiful young woman, who didn't come out of those woods alive that night. But for David Brown, obviously, it's been, without question, the longest and most difficult 2 years of his life.
17-year-old Cassidy Charette was killed and 20 other people injured, including David Brown himself. Lobozo says Brown has relived the accident every day since it happened.
But to get this behind him, I think, is huge. The state had made a number of offers a number of times, and he had simply been resolute in his feeling that there was absolutely no way he was going to plead guilty to something that he felt he didn't do.
In addition, Lobozo argued that the state of Maine does not regulate the operation of recreational hayrides. An attorney for the Charette family released a statement saying that not guilty in a criminal case does not mean not responsible, and they remain focused on a separate civil lawsuit and in finding other meaningful ways to honor Cassidy. Down in Washington, Maine Senator Susan Collins is worrying about the effects of a potential government shutdown. At a rare open meeting of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, Collins expressed concern over the impact of a shutdown on the nation's intelligence operations.
We are desperately trying to ensure that government keeps functioning and that we do not have any kind of government shutdown.
Collins, a Republican, is worried that Congress will fail to provide for at least a continuing resolution that would fund the federal government after the current budget runs out at the end of the week. Collins questioned Robert Cardillo, the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, who said that just the threat of a shutdown is already causing problems. He said staff that would normally be gathering intelligence have been shifted instead to planning for a potential shutdown. A bill that would keep the government operating past midnight Friday has been mired in a dispute over funding to deal with the drinking water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Meanwhile, the two candidates vying this year to win the chance to represent Maine's 2nd District in the U.S. House are likely giving voters a sense of déjà vu. In a redux of the same race 2 years ago, former Democratic state lawmaker Emily Kane is challenging former state treasurer Bruce Poliquin. Poliquin beat Kane in 2014 after winning 45% of the vote in a three-way race. This time around, campaign ads for the two are employing a similar strategy, trying to convince voters that their rivals aren't what they seem. A.J. Higgins has more.
Poliquin has been in office for 2 years, but he continues to be haunted by statements attributed to him 16 years ago. In an ad paid for by Kane, Poliquin is depicted as being anti-camping in a region of the state that thrives on outdoor activities.
I'm Emily Kane, and I approve this message.
Bruce Poliquin looked at a campground and said, "Those are not my kind of people." It makes you wonder, who are his kind of people? Well, he doesn't know anything about the people that are up north, like the campers, the hunters.
Kane's ad featuring Josh Kinson of Plymouth sends the message that Poliquin does not embrace the same outdoor values of many 2nd District voters. But saying that Poliquin doesn't belong in the woods is pretty tame when compared to the Democrats' Political Action Committee ad that suggests that the congressman doesn't even belong in the state.
We do things differently in Maine. Work hard and expect only what we've earned. But Congressman Poliquin came from Wall Street and has some different ideas.
In defense of Congressman Poliquin, the National Republican Congressional Committee quickly developed its own ad that characterized Emily Kane as a Clinton clone who helped out a country that promotes acts of terror.
Like Hillary Clinton, Emily Kane supports the nuclear deal with Iran. Kane says,
"We need to make sure we uphold the deal."
Even though Iran is a longtime sponsor of terrorism.
My campaign is all about the people that I meet every day. This is about how the story of my family meeting the ups and downs of the economy.
Kane says her campaign is focused on helping Mainers overcome everyday life challenges. Contrary to the image of a Washington insider like Clinton, Kane says she's a typical Mainer. and that voters need to examine their choices for the second district and the records of each candidate.
This is about the comparison of records, of who has a record of actually getting things done and working across the aisle, whether it was with House and Senate Republicans and even Governor LePage, to balance budgets, lower taxes, and do important things like growing our economy and breaking the cycle of domestic violence.
For his part, Poliquin rarely acknowledges that he even has an opponent and routinely avoids taking questions from the media. But he had this to say about Kane's camper ad.
This is the silly season. My grandparents are from Central Maine. My mom and dad were born and raised in Central Maine. I was born and raised in Central Maine. I understand the values of our hardworking families, and it's honesty, integrity, and hard work, and accepting everybody. And I'm French-Canadian Catholic, and we hug everybody. So, no, this is the silly season. I'm just focusing on my work for the people that I represent.
The dynamics in the race are attracting national attention. Roll Call, a Capitol Hill newspaper, recently focused on the efforts by each candidate to depict each other as out of touch with voters. The camper ad had its roots in a 16-year-old business dispute that Poliquin had with a camping area that adjoined his Popham Beach Club. The paper noted that Kane's ads continue to inform Mainers that she is, quote, one of us, even though she's from out of state. Amy Freed, a political science professor at the University of Maine, said the negative messaging is hardly unusual in today's politics.
It really is rather typical for a candidate to want to create a kind of brand for the candidate and the candidate's opponent. And one of the elements of that brand is whether you're like the average person, whether you're one of us.
Although Freed said it was difficult to say whether the ads are effective, a new poll undertaken this month by the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram, indicated that Poliquin was leading Kane by 10 points. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
And it was 20 years ago today that the tanker Julie N. collided with the bridge connecting Portland and South Portland, spilling 180,000 gallons of oil into the Four River. Keith Shortall looks back at the worst oil spill in Maine's history.
On September 27, 1996, the American-owned, Liberian-registered Julie N. was headed for the Inner Harbor with a load of nearly 9 million gallons of refined oil products when the accident occurred at mid-morning. The 560-foot-long ship, which had only 10 feet of clearance as it passed through, first struck the bridge abutment of the South Portland side. A federal investigator attributed the collision to an error by local tanker pilot James Mooney, who issued the wrong command.
The pilot freely admitted that he inadvertently asked for hard left instead of hard right. And the timing and the limited space in the bridge did not allow him to get the ship under control in time to avoid a collision.
The impact left a huge gash in the port side of the Julie N, spilling 180,000 gallons of heavy fuel oil and diesel into the Four River, which then-Governor Angus King witnessed firsthand as he toured the scene by boat.
Oh, yeah, there it is. There's the hole. There's the hole. Right at the waterline. Damn it all.
The spill was contained primarily to the Four River, but approximately $40 million was spent on cleaning up 14 miles of contaminated shoreline. The Coast Guard said at the time that nearly 80% of the spilled oil was recovered. Much of the rest stayed west of the bridge toward the marshes near the Portland Jetport and away from Casco Bay and the islands. Portland Harbor was closed for a while, and fishing and shellfish harvesting was banned in parts of Casco Bay and the Four River for more than a month. The damaged span, known as the Million Dollar Bridge, was replaced a year later with the Casco Bay Bridge, which now offers twice as much clearance. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Keith Shortall.
And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
We are now locked into a static weather pattern with high pressure anchored to Ontario and low pressure pinned to the Mid-Atlantic states, and this is going to last for days and days. Clouds will regroup tonight, where they thinned out earlier today. Areas of drizzle and fog will develop across the southern half, especially the coastal plain, near 40 north, low 50 south. Tomorrow's sunshine will be limited, brightest throughout central Maine. There'll be a few scattered showers along the south coastal plain late in the day with some mist involved. Mid-50s to low 60s, coolest far north and the south coast. Thursday and Friday will offer a blend of sun and clouds, brightest north of Rangeley, Millinocket, and Danforth. Only coastal and York counties will be under the gun for a few misty moments. Mid-50s to mid-60s, warmest throughout central Maine. Showers will blossom throughout southern Maine Saturday and will envelop the entire state Sunday, yet temperatures will trend well above normal for early October. Nighttime temperatures are remarkably warm. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
That's the news on This Day in Maine, Tuesday, September 27th, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Patty White, A.J. Higgins, Fred Bever, Kathleen Masterson, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.